All right. Well, I think we'll go ahead and get started. People may wander in. I recognize many faces from yesterday and some new faces. So I'll reintroduce myself. I'm Maren, and I'm a physician. I work as a general internist. I work as a hospitalist, which means that I care for hospitalized patients. I don't have a clinic. And I work at a small public hospital that's affiliated with Harvard Medical School in Boston. So I teach medical students and residents. And I also have a leadership role in our hospital related to quality and making the hospital work better. And I'm not an expert in the Bible. I'm not a theologian. I'm a Christian. And I care about the conversation between religion and spirituality and healthcare as an individual and as a professional. But I am not coming to you from a platform of expertise, but rather from a place where we can kind of think together about these positions. So, how many of you actually work in healthcare in the room? All right, great. Welcome back. So, each of these sessions is intended to be a standalone session, but in the interest of getting everybody onto the same page, I'm just going to briefly review what we talked about yesterday. So, we started by brainstorming a little bit about our own experiences with the healthcare system. And we brainstormed ultimately in sort of three different categories. First, our own understanding about the experience of illness, disease, sickness, and what it means to be sick. And then what the response of the healthcare system is to these experiences of being ill and having diseases. And then finally, what the role of faith and the faith community and churches has been in our own lives and the lives of our families when we become sick. So that's not going to work very well. So maybe I'll turn it this way. So in brainstorming about illness, we recognized that there's a lot of different kinds of illness. Sometimes we're talking about catastrophic accidents. Sometimes we're talking about progressive chronic conditions. We recognized that illness affects not only individuals, but also families. We recognize that illness is often full of pain and suffering. Sometimes it ends in death. And the experiences of being ill are fundamentally subjective. So whether something is major or minor, how we feel about it, we recognize is a subjective decision. And when we engage the healthcare system objectifies our subjective experience and tries to respond to it. And people's experience in the healthcare system, I think, really emphasized some of the themes that we will continue to engage over the course of the rest of the week, which is that people come into the healthcare system, and sometimes they find caring individuals, and they find themselves healed by the care of individual people working in sometimes very complex and broken systems. But people also experience compartmentalization and a kind of focus on the technical details of the body as a machine, and sometimes lack of attention to the whole experience of being a human being in a body. And sometimes difficulty that the healthcare system has in keeping the big picture and questions of meaning in mind, instead focused on small details. And people had experiences of being sick and having the church community be helpful, bringing meals and transportation and laundry. People had the experience of the church community praying. People had the experience of praying for themselves, praying for their family, praying for other people. Some people had experiences in church-affiliated hospitals where there was sort of an integration between healthcare and the church community. And people also shared experiences of the church inviting people to participate in activities and giving people ways of being more fully alive. So in summary, I would say we took these experiences and then put them into a framework. And so I'm going to give you sort of my summary of these provocations from day one. That we talked a little bit about the tension between infinite need and finite ways of responding. We talked about the tension between subjective experiences and objectifying the experience of illness in the healthcare system. We talked about this universality, which is human condition, which is a need for healing. and the need for particular responses when particular individual people get sick in particular ways. So there's this need for health and healing that is infinite and universal, but the healthcare system necessarily responds to this need in finite and particular ways. Although the healthcare system necessarily responds to sickness objectively, the experience is inherently subjective. And although the healthcare system and the church have historically shared an aim related to health and wholeness, I made an argument that the contemporary U.S. healthcare system has sort of spiritually lost its way. And the reason that it has lost its way, I said yesterday, is that medical technology and the complexity of the bureaucracy in which we practice medicine have distracted us from some of the core principles of healing that are at the root of what we do. So the unprecedented advances in medical technology in the last 50 years have deluded us into thinking that we can save ourselves from our finitude. And finally, the dominant social discourse about the complex social, political, and economic relationships that comprise modern U.S. healthcare is incomplete. And I said it was incomplete because the notion of the human being that is at root in the dominant culture within medicine is kind of a human being as a body that is a machine. And it is not a construct that recognizes the complexity of what it means to be human in a wider sort of relationship. And I said that I thought we were going to be in trouble in this country if our conversations about healthcare stayed focused on this limited notion of what it means to be human, and that we actually were going to need to expand our conversation in order to get to something that was going to help us be more whole as individuals and as a community. For those of you who were here yesterday, or those of you who weren't, I know this is kind of a lot and it's big, but just as a way of framing, any comments that people want to add, or questions, things that weren't clear?
Martin, the fourth point there jumps out at me, and maybe I wasn't part of the conversation yesterday, but it strikes me that medical technology certainly is a powerful tool and has a place, and that a big part that I see is part of my limited understanding of is that that technology is available to a small slice of the population. There's so many people for whom it could be a very important part, and it just isn't available.
Yes.
Regardless of our whole definition of health and wholeness.
Yep, I think that is absolutely true, and that's actually the theme that we're, it's part of the theme that we're going to take up today. I think that that's actually a theme that we'll take up more on tomorrow, which is that I think most of our conversations about healthcare in the public policy arena right now talk about that. They talk about access to our existing technologies as though access to these technologies is going to produce health and healing. And my argument is actually a little different, that although that's really important, that we have more equity and more access to the healthcare system as we have actually laid it out, is not capable of producing the kind of health and wholeness that we actually want. That it's gonna be more than technology, no matter how many bone marrow transplants and no matter how sophisticated our pharmaceuticals and our imaging technology, it actually doesn't create the well-being that we long for and hope for and that God wants for us. Yeah.
Well, isn't it more crisis-oriented, too?
Yes.
I mean, if you think about just the whole system of the heart, I mean, they're kind of like waiting for you to have a heart attack, and then they'll go into stents and blah, blah, blah.
Yes.
Or say, lower your cholesterol before, what else do they tell you?
Yeah, there's so that's I think a very, very important point and part of actually what we're gonna engage today, which is that so in Greek medical history there was the cult of Aesculapius and the cult of Hygieia, two different Greek gods. The cult of Aesculapius was what we would consider to be medical care right now. And that is the response to crises. It's rescue medicine. The cult of Hygieia, where we get our word hygiene, has to do with preventive medicine and public health. And in the contemporary world, if those two Greek gods are still fighting, Aesculapius has won and Hygieia has lost, for sure. Yes. All right. As a way of getting started today, I want to introduce this this premise that I think one way of thinking about health and healing is that healing is about the restoration of right relationships. So what kind of relationships do I mean? What can you imagine? What kind of relationships need to be right in order to be whole?
Support.
So you're thinking about relationships between people, within your sort of friends, family, community. Absolutely.
Doctor and patient.
Okay. So there is a relationship between the doctor and patient, which is a part of these interpersonal relationships, which has to be whole.
Faith.
Yeah. So there's a relationship with the transcendent in some way. If we believe, as we do, that being human puts us in relationship to the divine in some way, that's an important part of healing. And disease, if disease is a disruption of right relationships, one of the things that gets threatened when we get critically ill is our relationship to the divine. We wonder what it all means. And so healing actually is a restoration of that relationship as well.
I think of mind-body, you know, how do we think of ourselves in the world and our bodies? How do they
Absolutely.
Operate?
So the experience of disease is often first manifested as a set of physical symptoms, but it affects our identity, our relationship to ourselves, our relationship to our body. So in addition to healing within the body, there's a healing of the mind-body relationship, which is a healing of our sense of ourselves as being whole. So there's a healing that has to do with sort of the realm of meaning and cognitive understanding and the mind-body relationship. Absolutely. Yeah?
With food.
Yes, so I think that there are things
For example, I look at a few people that have jerk, and you watch the way they eat, and it makes sense to you that they'd have jerk, but instead of having this relationship, shutting off the TV, sitting down and really paying attention to the food relationship, knowing where it comes from, etc., they take that medicine, whatever it is, or food pill,
yes.
Which causes all kinds of other problems.
Yes, absolutely. So you're talking about indigestion. Indigestion is sort of part of being human. And if you eat too much too fast, you're going to have more of it. And if your belly is very big, it's going to push your stomach into your chest and your acid is going to go up into your esophagus and you're going to feel indigestion. You can take a pill for that, or you could actually recalibrate your relationship to eating and actually manage your indigestion in a different way. So there's our relationships not only to our body, but our behavior and our lifestyles. Absolutely.
Well, also, Mark, I think talking about feeling, a part of it is just the relationship of our organs and ourselves to one another, too. I mean, we can't think of that as a big part of healing.
Absolutely.
So, balancing our left, rights, and our.
Yes, absolutely. So, if we were going to make a sort of a picture, unfortunately, I just have words up here, but I think it would be possible to make this as a picture that would be more interesting and more fun to look at. But if you think about health as right relationships, it probably starts here as physical relationships of cells, proteins within cells and cells within organs, and organs were in relationship to one another, and physiological processes and biochemical processes. So there's a physical set of relationships within the body itself that are important for healing. And then at the second level, still within your own self, there's a relationship between your mind and your body. So there's a relationship between the physical relationships that are at work in your body, and then there's how you think about it. And I know, as a person who works in the hospital, I admit people to the hospital every single time I'm on call with chest discomfort that has nothing to do with a problem in their heart. It's the way in which they're carrying their anxiety or their fear or their worry or their sadness or their despair. They can't talk about that, they don't know that, they can't access that, but what they can access is this incredible heaviness, this weight on their chest. And I admit people to the hospital, and we cycle their cardiac enzymes, and we do electrocardiograms, and we run them on stress tests, you know, treadmills, and we say, your heart looks good, good luck. And we send them out. And that's what the medical system does. So there's a huge relationship between how we experience our symptoms and how we think about them. There's a mind-body relationship. And then there's a relationship with the physical environment in which we live. There's a relationship with the interpersonal environment, our friends, our family, our community, larger political structures. And then there's a relationship with the divine in some way. So you could play with this model, but the point is that I think it's possible to think about healing as being in right relation. And for sure, the medical system that we live in focuses on this and tends to ignore the rest of these relationships. So today, we're going to move down here a little bit to think about these relationships and what role they play in well-being. And we're going to start with some biblical texts. So this is a text that we looked at the very end of this yesterday when I was framing the history of the Judaic relationship to God and healing. So this is a passage from the Hebrew people's exile in the wilderness. Then Moses led Israel from the Red Sea, and they went out into the wilderness of Shur, and they went 3 days in the wilderness and found no water. When they came to Marah, they could not drink the waters of Marah, for they were bitter. Therefore, it was named Marah. So the people grumbled at Moses, saying, "What shall we drink?" Then he cried out to the Lord, and the Lord showed him a tree. And he threw it into the waters, and the waters became sweet. There he made for them a statute and regulation, and there he tested them. And he said, "If you give earnest heed to the voice of the Lord your God and do what is right in his sight and give ear to all his statutes, I will put none of the diseases on you which I have put on the Egyptians, for I, the Lord, am your healer." So I would invite you to think, just in your own knowledge of the Hebrew Bible, what are these statutes and regulations that God intended for his people to live by? Okay, so there were dietary laws. There were lots of instructions about how to eat.
Cleanliness.
Okay, there were lots of instructions about how to stay clean. So things that we would attribute to the Greek cult of Hygieia, how to eat and how to keep clean.
Commandments.
Yeah, there were commandments. Absolutely. About that teach us about how to be in right relation to other people and how to be in right relation to God, right?
Blood laws.
Blood laws, what are those?
It's a big part of Leviticus and parts of Exodus and Deuteronomy that talk about how you contaminate blood. Menstrual blood, moon blood, same thing with like leprosy. Leprosy, lepers aren't clean, and arguably you could say that what they're dealing with blood source.
So bloodborne infections and contagion. And absolutely.
There's it starts in Genesis with Cain and Abel, the shedding of blood. The blood is very important to us. Both religious ritual, but also as a means to, blood is life.
Uh-huh.
You have to treat life sacred. So you have to treat blood differently than you treat other material things.
Interesting. And that probably has, it has two layers of import for our conversation. Both it's a respect for the sort of public health implications of contagious disease, but it's also this sense of reverence for life and respect for life and the complexity of life, the beauty of life, what is holy about it, that is fundamental to being in right relation. Yeah?
One of the constant themes is, remember that you were slaves in Israel, and so don't oppress others. Take care of those who are marginal or widowed and orphaned.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think of the laws about gleaning, right? Don't harvest all of your food, but leave a little bit around the edges for the widows and the orphans. I think about the year of Jubilee, that every 50 years, all land goes back to its original owners, that people actually don't acquire wealth that is perpetuated, and that there's a way in which we, as people living in community, need to figure out how to live justly. So I think that there's you know, there are lots of ways of reading the Bible, and there's lots of narratives in the Bible, but this is definitely one narrative in the Bible, a narrative that says that God is committed to justice and to the well-being of the public, and that God has helped us figure out how to do that, how to create public health by looking at attention to all of these laws and regulations. And I think that if you read the Bible in that way, you can see that all of the prophets call the people of Israel back to justice. They speak out against authority. They speak out against injustice. They accuse kings and rulers and the wealthy of ignoring the poor. And you can find that in every prophetic book. So this is a familiar passage. Let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like an ever-rolling stream. This comes after, you know, a long tirade, a vindictive set of kind of phrases about woe to you fat cats who are ignoring the poor. And then if you read the Bible with this narrative, you come to Jesus, who announces himself in this same prophetic tradition. This is his statement of ministry. He says, the Spirit of the Lord is upon me, and because he has anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor, he has sent me to proclaim release to the captives, recovery of sight to the blind, and set free those who are downtrodden, to proclaim the favorable year of the Lord. This is the year of Jubilee in the text, in the Isaiah text, that it comes from, so that we live in this tradition, I think, where Jesus announces himself to be about the work of justice when he comes to deliver his statement on ministry. So with that as a frame, I want to turn to a video. So this actually is a video that was prepared by a documentary filmmaking company. It comes from a series called Unnatural Causes, and there are 7 of these videos in this series in which it explores something that the field of public health has called the social determinants of health. And this is just a 5-minute video clip that introduces some of the themes that the full 7-session series actually explores. So let me play this for you. And as I play it, I'm just inviting you to think about this biblical frame that we just explored, and think about what it means for our healthcare system today. Okay.
Yeah, move that up.
We grow up as children, we grow up as adults, and continue. We interact constantly with the world in which we are engaged. That's the way in which our biology actually happens. We carry our history in our bodies. How could we not?
Living in America should be a ticket to good health. We have the highest gross national product in the world.
I'm very happy to finally have some of my cars in one location, some of them.
We spend $2 trillion per year on medical care. That's nearly half of all the health dollars spent in the world. But we've seen our statistics. We live shorter, often sicker lives than in any other industrialized country. We rank 30th in life expectancy.
Especially of economically developed countries, we are at the bottom of the list.
A higher percentage of our babies die in their first year of life than in Malta, Slovenia, Cyprus. How can this be? Is this just because 47 million of us have no health insurance?
Healthcare can deal with the diseases and illnesses, but a lack of healthcare is not the cause of illness and disease. It is like saying, since aspirin cures a fever, that the lack of aspirin must be the cause of the fever.
Or is it mostly because of our American diet and personal health behaviors?
Those behaviors themselves are in part determined by economic status. And so our ability to avoid smoking and eat a healthy diet depends in turn on our access to income, education, and what we call the social determinants of health.
But wouldn't our genes trump social determinants of health?
Among twins who lived together until age 18, who basically grew up in the same households, so had at least a relatively similar exposure, if they diverged later in life, if one became professional and the other was working class, they ended up with different health status as adults. This is among identical twins.
Written into our bodies is a lifetime of experience, shaped by social conditions and policies that can determine who will be sicker, who will die sooner.
There are ways in which our society is organized that are bad for our health. And there's no doubt that we could reconfigure ourselves in ways that would benefit our health.
There are huge inequalities in this society. All this wealth is maldistributed.
Pet food, ice for the pets, water.
And I think that's in part why the U.S. as a whole has relatively poor health amongst the rich countries, and why even the better off people are suffering. And we think that that is not inevitable.
All right, so that's, the whole series is actually wonderful, and if we had more time, I would be happy to show you a little bit more, but I think it's more important that we talk. So I'm not gonna show you any more of that series. The people that put this together prepared a little 10-point fact sheet. So I'm going to pass that out, and we're just going to read these facts out loud. I'm just going to ask people as a volunteer. I think that will help to frame our conversation. I only made 30, so share with your neighbor if people don't have one. So I think this is a nice summary of the points that the series actually explores in greater detail with a lot of specific examples of individual communities. So I just ask for a voice. Go ahead and read the first one.
Health is more than health care. Doctors treat us when we're ill, but what makes us healthy or sick in the first place? Research shows that social conditions, the jobs we do, the money we're paid, the schools we attend, the neighborhoods we live in, are as important to our health as our genes, our behavior, or even our medical care.
Health is tied to the distribution of resources. The single strongest predictor of our health is our position on the class pyramid. Whether measured by income, schooling, or occupation, those at the top have the most power and resources and, on average, live longer and healthier lives. Those at the bottom are most disempowered and get sicker and die younger. The rest of us all fall somewhere in between. On average, people in the middle are almost twice as likely to die in early death compared to those at the top. Those at the bottom, four times as likely. Even among people who smoke, poor smokers have a greater risk of dying than rich smokers.
Number three.
Racism imposes an added health burden. prejudice, the degree of hope and optimism people have, differential access and treatment by the healthcare system. All of these can impact health.
The choices we make are shaped by the choices we have. Individual behaviors, smoking, diet, drinking, and exercise matter for health. But making healthy choices isn't just about self-discipline. Some neighborhoods have easier access to fresh, affordable produce. Others have only fast food joints and liquor and convenience stores. Some have nice homes, clean parks, safe places to walk, jog, bike, or play, and well-financed schools offering gym, art, music, and after-school programs, and some don't. What government and corporate practices can better ensure healthy spaces and places for everyone?
High demand plus low control equals chronic stress. It's not CEOs who are dying of heart attacks, it's their subordinates. People at the top certainly face pressure, but they are more likely to have the power and resources to manage those pressures. The lower in the pecking order we are, the greater our exposure to forces that can upset our lives. Insecure and low-paying jobs, uncontrolled debt, capricious supervisors, unreliable transportation, poor childcare, no health care, noisy and violent living conditions. And the less access we have to the money, power, knowledge, and social connections that can help us cope and gain control over these forces.
Six.
Chronic stress can be toxic. Exposure to fear and uncertainty triggers a stress response. Our bodies go on alert. The heart beats faster. Blood pressure rises. Glucose floods the bloodstream. All so we can hit harder or run faster until the threat passes. But when threats are constant and unrelenting, our physiological systems don't return to normal. Like gunning the engine of a car, this constant state of arousal, even if low level, wears us down over time, increasing our risk for disease.
Number seven.
Inequality, economic and political, is bad for our health. The United States has by far the most inequality in the industrialized world, and the worst health. The top 1% now owns as much wealth as the bottom 90%. Tax breaks for the rich, deregulation, and the decline of unions, racism, and segregation, outsourcing and globalization, and cuts in social programs destabilize communities and channel wealth and power and health to the few at the expense of the many. Economic inequality in the U.S. is now greater than at any time since the 1920s.
Number eight.
Social policy is health policy. Average life expectancy in the U.S. improved by 30 years during the 20th century. Researchers attribute much of that increase not to drugs or medical technology, but to social change. For example, improved wage and work standards, universal schooling, improved sanitation and housing, and civil rights laws. Social measures like living wage jobs, paid sick and family leave, guaranteed vacations, universal preschool and access to college, and universal health care can further extend our lives by improving our lives. These are as much health issues as diet, smoking, and exercise.
Number nine.
Health inequalities are not natural. Health differences that arise from our racial and class inequalities result from decisions we as a society have made and can be made differently. Other rich nations already have in two important ways. They make sure inequality is less. For example, Sweden's relative child poverty rate after transfers is 4% compared to our 22%. And they try to ensure that everyone has access to health-promoting resources, regardless of their personal wealth. For example, good schools and health care are available to everyone, not just the affluent. They live healthier, longer lives than we do.
Number 10.
We all pay the price for poor health. It's not only the poor, but also the middle classes whose health is suffering. We already spend $2 trillion a year to patch up our bodies, more than twice per person than the average rich country spends. And our healthcare system is strained to the breaking point. Yet our life expectancy is 29th in the world, infant mortality 30th, and lost productivity due to illness costs businesses more than $1 trillion a year. As a society, we face a choice. Invest in the conditions that can improve health today, or pay to repair the bodies tomorrow.
All right. So where does that meet you? So what resonates with you, and what are you resistant to from that frame?
I'll share just one piece. A couple of these popped up. I do city planning work, and mm-hmm. so it's become an issue in city planning, active living, healthy living, and there's a set of indicators that now many cities are looking at that include, for the first time, how far are most of the residential areas from grocery stores and self-fresh food?
Mm-hmm.
What is the condition of the sidewalk and trail system? Is it safe from a traffic point of view? Is it lighted at night so that people can actually use it safely? And there's a whole host of these things that a number of organizations have started to put out there. And mm-hmm. also just the basic research about neighborhoods and how people live has spawned a movement called the Blue Zones that has found these places that wouldn't appear to have any advantage culturally, economically, otherwise, and yet they're places where they've found strikingly low incidence of disease, especially cancer and heart disease, and they look at them and it's been largely ethnic communities where everybody knows each other and they do business in the neighborhood, and so the social structure significantly impacts the health of the people. And so it's something that as city planners we're starting to pay attention to.
Mm-hmm. That's fascinating. And is that a dominant perspective in city planning?
I'd say it's growing and accepted, but it's still, you know, I've been doing this for 35 years, and I'd say I've seen it start to rise in the last 5 or 10 years.
And what is the name of the construct from a public planning perspective?
Well, it goes in a couple of names. I mean, Blue Zones is kind of jargon for this organization that said these places where this happens in a very healthy way are called Blue Zones.
Mm-hmm.
And then active living or healthy living, mm-hmm. there's kind of a number of kind of tests or indicators or analyses that center around that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What state do you live in?
Minnesota.
Doesn't surprise me.
But we didn't invent it. We didn't invent this stuff. But I was born and raised
in Minneapolis.
So one of the longer version of the video that I felt like we didn't have time to look at actually contrasts two neighborhoods, and one of them is in Richmond, California, which is a very unhappy, unhealthy neighborhood. And the other is a neighborhood outside of Seattle, and I'm not remembering off the top of my head what the name of the community is, but it's a community that has actually taken these principles very seriously in terms of thinking about nodes where people gather in public spaces and how to facilitate relationships. But they've also actually taken it one step further and thought about, you know, when we're building housing, how can we ensure that ventilation in this particular space is going to be good for children with asthma. And so there are, you know, clean living units or breathe easy units, High Point, yeah, where they've been very attentive to what kind of volatile gases are off-gassing from the paints that are used and from the various products that are used. And, you know, they've managed to reduce emergency department visits for children with asthma by astronomical proportions. Other places where this connects with your own life, things that feel true or things that you're suspicious of, connects with work that you're doing?
In the museum community at the AAM, the American Association of Museums conference this year, there were a couple sessions on museum exhibits coming from different disciplines, whether science museums, natural history museums, and other places, where they talked about health and wellness issues too. So it's bubbling up in that field. A couple of the presentations, it was very interesting that it wasn't something that the museum professionals brought forward, but the community around them. A lot of times communities that didn't normally go to the museum came and said, could you do an exhibit about nutrition or something? There was one really moving one about a Native American cultural center where they were asked by community healthcare professionals if they could do an exhibit on American Indians and diabetes, which brought in a whole new set of people who had never been to a museum before, and how important that was just to do some of the hands-on sort of tactile demonstrations that museum exhibits can do as a way of doing community education.
Wow, that's fabulous.
Yeah.
It's so fun to think about, you know, who's a community health worker? And if we were to just brainstorm that list, I don't think that museum director would have shown up if we were just brainstorming.
Yeah.
But when you think about how many sectors it actually takes working together to produce well-being for the community, it's dramatic. Yeah.
I wonder how much the news reports and things like that have to do with poor health. Because it seems like the majority of everything that comes on the news is who was killed overnight, who was in an accident, who, you know, I mean, and then maybe on the tail end has something about good news, but it's just like it's stuck in and you think, come on.
Well, certainly the media, our sort of public storyteller, has a huge role to play in how we think about ourselves and how we think about health. And I would say the dominant paradigm in the news media related to health is not this. The dominant paradigm is actually, you know, what does Sanjay Gupta say? I mean, it's mostly about the medical care system is usually what we talk about.
Right.
And then I think there's also a tendency not to. I think both of your two comments were opportunities to think about where is this actually working as opposed to where is it not working. And I think there's a lot of energy that is generated by attention to what social movement theory would call positive deviance. Look for where it's working, try to learn from where it's working, and do more of that as opposed to focusing exclusively on where things are not working and where things are falling apart. Yeah.
Some of these seem to deal with, you know, making individual choices is a personal thing in terms of it, but a vast majority of them tend to be more of a civil or a society. We as a society have to make the choices.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the frame is that we make individual choices, but we make those choices in context, and our choice making is actually not as. We don't have actually 180 degrees of freedom or 360 degrees of freedom. We have, we make choices in the context of a set of options that are in front of us. And this movement also has coined the phrase geography of opportunity. And, you know, when you compare the health indicators in one zip code and find that the zip code next door has dramatically different health indicators, you know that there's something happening there that is not just about all these people who happen to live in this neighborhood are terrible choice makers, and all these people are phenomenally good choice makers. It's got to be something more. When it aggregates by zip code, there's something else going on.
Well, and that also relates to public policy in the designer cities, that there are rules that every city has, the zoning laws and others that dictate how it will develop, and those govern the set of choices. And you say, oh, wouldn't it be great if people would make the healthy choice to walk to work, but the location of affordable housing is not near the employment centers, and it's simply not a feasible choice for many people to walk to work from where they are, which creates stress. And it's like, well, okay, they can get there by bus, but you've got a lousy transit system. That creates stress if you're on the bus for 2 hours to try and whatever. Then there's a whole cascading series of choices that if we as a public take these systems seriously, we can put them together in ways that might be healthier for more people.
Yeah.
Even the whole issue that simple grocery stores being accessible, I mean, that's a huge issue or dead zone where you don't have accessible the health grocery stores. stores. I mean, the, you know, talk about city planning, but it's very, you quickly see, even in we were in Portland, and quickly you've seen grocery stores that existed no longer exist, and the distance that people have to go to get affordable groceries, it's amazing how that's happened. And I don't think we're referring to that.
Yes, absolutely. Food desert is the name of that
phenomenon.
Well, the alternative, you tuck this away, food swamp is the one that, you know, the prevalence of convenience stores and fast food are the only food source in a within a community.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm struck that these, to me, these 10 things seem so much common sense. It just resonates that this is the way the world works. But yet our political conversation is trying to move us in the direction that this tells us is just wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you take away benefits for the those that have less. That somehow we can make it better.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. Is your point related to that one or different?
Yeah, similar. Yeah. One that sticks out is chronic stress is toxic. And just the whole, I'm a massage therapist, one of the energy healer, and the idea that people don't want to spend the money on themselves to get a massage because it's frivolous.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas my cousin works as a nurse practitioner in hospice, and she said, no, you know, if you lower someone's pain, if you lower their stress and lower their pain, they live longer.
Mm-hmm.
There's this whole attitude of, oh, I can't spend money on myself. I shouldn't be doing that. To lower stress. It doesn't even have to be for a specific reason,
mm-hmm.
Or a specific area. You know, but we're so hesitant as a society, as people, to do that,
mm-hmm.
to take care of ourselves.
Yeah, absolutely. So stress, you know, stress is a physiological phenomenon, and you can measure it in the body with the stress hormones, specifically cortisol. So you can actually measure the level of stress the amount of physiological stress that somebody is under. And cortisol suppresses the immune system and has all sorts of very direct effects on the body. And it's quite clear that, I mean, there's a lot of research about the relationship between stress and a lot of different health outcomes. This guy who was quoted at the end of the video, his name is Marmot, Marmot. He's a social epidemiologist in England. And he actually has done probably the most elegant studies about the relationship between stress and social class over time. And it's dramatic. I mean, it's always, if you can stratify society into 5 quintiles, whether it's education or income or social status, stress is absolutely linearly related to the place that you are in the social hierarchy. And disease outcomes are, many, many disease outcomes are related to stress in very, very clear ways. Getting back to your point about the political conversation. So when I read these things, they feel intuitively obvious to me, and I don't know if that's true for others of you in the room. But this framework about the social determinants of health is not a new idea. So people have been talking about the social determinants of health it's been sort of a sub-conversation within the conversation about health and medicine throughout the last century. And it's never gotten a lot of traction. It's actually never gotten a lot, yeah. Okay, so it's never entered into the policy discourse about health in a way that seems to galvanize public conversation. And the RWJ, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, recently commissioned a series of really interesting focus groups where they tried to figure out, what's wrong with this framing? Why is it not galvanizing people? Why are we not able to legislate in such a way that we could create healthier communities? What's getting in the way? And so they actually had groups of Republicans and groups of Democrats, people who identify themselves in that way, talking to one another, making collages, drawing pictures, telling stories, and then they did this very comprehensive qualitative analysis of the frames that Democrats and Republicans use to think about this phenomenon, the social determinants of health and its contribution to health outcomes. And what they found is that Democrats and Republicans, that Democrats and Republicans actually had very different, they called them deep metaphors for thinking about these things. And the three deep metaphors that Democrats seem to use to think about these things were system, container, and balance. By system, what they meant is that Democrats tend to think about, that these things tend to resonate for Democrats because they think about the way in which things are interrelated as a complex web of interrelationships that produces the outcomes. So metaphors that rely on some understanding of society as a system seem to resonate pretty deeply with most Democrats. Democrats also tend to think about poverty as a place that traps you, as a container. And in order to get out of this container, you need some help. Democrats also tend to think about balance as a core value, so that one of the jobs, Democrats believe, of government is to ensure greater equity and better balance, to give everybody a fair shake, to move people at the bottom up into the middle, and that sort of resonates with most Democrats. Republicans, by contrast, tend to use metaphors that look more like journeys, so that health is a journey that you're on, and on this path, you make choices, and your choices lead you to different destinations depending on the choices that you make on your journey towards health. And Republicans also tend to think a lot about resources. What resources do you have access to? How do you use your resources? Do you use them effectively in order to travel on this path to your destination of well-being? And for Republicans, balance is actually kind of a bad word. So balance, instead of meaning equity and bringing the bottom up, balance for Republicans in this deep metaphor analysis meant stealing from the people at the top in ways that were unfair, and leveling the playing field in a way that actually jeopardizes the top. And so they suggest, this Robert Wood Johnson Foundation study suggests, that if we're going to talk about the social determinants of health in a way that we can bridge gaps between the frame that Democrats come to this with and the frame that Republicans come to this with, we have to avoid some particular sort of swamps that we get stuck in. Knowing that balance is actually going to be not a place where people are going, and equity and equality, that's not going to be a place that we're going to get a lot of unanimity and opinion. So we need to use a different frame. So they tested this message quite a bit, and found, and they, there's a, on their website, you can actually see how they've dissected this message in terms of trying to figure out why it resonates. But it resonated very well with a wide population, and was effective in actually getting people to agree that a focus on the social determinants of health was a worthwhile focus for health policy. So I'll read it to you. America leads the world in medical research and medical care, and for all we spend on healthcare, we should be the healthiest people on earth. So no statement that doesn't start with a triumphal statement about the power of American medicine is doomed to failure, right? So America leads the world in medical research and medical care, and for all we spend on healthcare, we should be the healthiest people on earth. Yet, on some of the most important indicators, like how long we live, we're not even in the top 25, behind countries like Bosnia and Jordan. It's time for America to lead again on health, and that means taking three steps. The first is to ensure that everyone can afford to see a doctor when they're sick, avoiding the word insurance. The second is to build preventive care, like screening for cancer and heart disease, into every healthcare plan and make it available to people who otherwise won't or can't go in for it, in malls and other public places where it's easy to stop for a test. The third is to stop thinking of health as something we get at the doctor's office, but instead as something that starts in our families, in our schools and workplaces, in our playgrounds and parks, in the air we breathe and the water we drink. The more you see the problem of health this way, the more opportunities you have to improve it. Scientists have found that the conditions in which we live and work have an enormous impact on our health, long before we ever see a doctor. It's time to expand the way we think about health to include how to keep it, not just how to get it back.
So what are they going to do with this statement?
I think that's a great question.
Well, I agree with that 100%.
Yeah, but I agree. I think that's the question. I mean, the question I'm asking myself is, what am I going to do with this? Because the Robert Wood Johnson just did the focus group research to understand how to frame the marketing. But the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation isn't an advocacy group.
Right.
I mean, they're funding a lot of research and social programs, sort of small pilot interventions to try to work on targeting some of these conditions.
And who was it who commissioned them to do their big study?
So they did it themselves because they've been funding research on the health of vulnerable populations for a long time and feeling frustrated about how do we actually leverage change with the research that we're doing. Yeah.
It seems to me there's a lot of people who make a lot of money on us not being well. Mm-hmm. And that our whole economic structure, there's a freedom to be able to, if I can convince you that you want something, it doesn't have to be good for you. If I can make money on doing that, there's an incentive for me to sell you hamburgers with lots of cheese on them and add bacon nonetheless, and tell you that that's a good meal, and create a culture within that economy that is impossible to do this. To me, that's what I've always struggled the most with in terms of working with in almost any area that I've worked. There's a force, the dark force, I like to call it, but it's a force that totally works against our being healthy. I ran into it in the juvenile court, the whole issue of child abuse. Now that's one that, at least in my mind, is kind of like medical health. It should be a no-brainer. And yet there's huge resistive forces with a lot of money that don't want us to be healthy. And you run into walls that basically prevent this, which, and this. I mean, the thing, it's logical, it makes sense, it's healthy. Why would there be any arguments against it? And yet there's huge forces that are against it. And I don't know what to do about it, but it makes me really angry.
Well, and especially you say that, I agree about people who are constantly just eating the bacon cheeseburgers, and it's no wonder they're not healthy. And yet, in an environment with lots of healthy choices, I think you could eat a bacon cheeseburger once a week and be just fine if all these other things are in place, if all the other relationships were in place, and you had strong family and community and et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah, it's when cheeseburgers are the only choice and you're stuck in this model, then it doesn't work.
So I'm conscious that it's actually noon and we need to close. Does anybody have one last comment before we close up?
I see. You know, the biggest problem that I see is Monsanto and what they're doing to food supply, genetic engineering. And I mean, when Europe won't even take our food, or if they, I mean, if there's nothing in it, I mean, products that says they're being engineered. I get really upset about this, and we're not stopping them.
So the goal today was to open up our notion of what health is, and I think to think about this social determinants of health and this sort of public health agenda. Which I think actually we have a Judeo-Christian commitment to. I think we can find it in our tradition. And I leave you with this, although it's possible to think about the enemies and Monsanto and whoever it is that wants us to be, Voldemort or whoever it is that is actually working to destroy our lives. There I believe, is room for common ground on both sides of the political aisle, because I actually believe that that most of us do share a commitment to personal and collective wellness. If we can find the way of actually galvanizing and mobilizing people to that. So I will invite us to continue our conversations tomorrow, thinking not only about kind of the world out there, but also ourselves, our own health, and our invitation to participate in making the world healthier. Thank you.
Thank you.